The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist, where we deal with everything concerning the Slavic nations of the world and their relationship to the Orthodox faith and Orthodox theology. That's what we do here, and from a political point of view, what we do is we use this particular mentality as a potent weapon, a particularly potent weapon against the New World Order. And I've been arguing for some time that the Orthodox nationalists of the Slavic and Hellenic worlds are a thorn in the side of the New World Order and will continue to be so, and their treatment under the dominant figures of the New World Order clearly prove that they are viewed as a threat and viewed as a problem. In general, we deal with the Ukrainian worlds, specifically the Ukrainian Orthodox Church and its nationalist point of view. And so we've dealt with everything from Russian serfdom to the commune to Gogol to Penteleimon Kulish. This is something that I specialize in, and clearly it's on a lot of people's minds because of a lot of the heat that I've taken over the years. And I apologize, by the way, to anybody to whom I've overreacted. I have a tendency to be very harsh and very difficult in my personality and in my approach to things, and I don't like that. But it is true, and I do apologize if I've offended anyone, especially those who really do have the European Christian mind at heart, and its welfare, and it keeps that to heart. We are, you know, allies after all. But today we're going to deal with an empire that I do view, along with the Russian Empire, as far more humane than is normally reported in the mainstream academic literature, and that is the Empire of Austria. I've dealt with the Russian Empire at great length in my career, and although there are certain aspects of it, my defense of the Russian Empire, that I have in fact withdrawn, and that's the case. When my first book came out back in 02 or whatever it was, The Third Rome, I made arguments concerning the importance and moral and political health of the Russian Tsarist Empire. Many of those arguments I do hold to today. However, there are certain aspects of that I have withdrawn, and one of them happens to be the Russian economic expansion of the second half of the 19th century, since most of that expansion came at the expense of the Ukrainian territories absorbed after the partition of Poland. And once I came to that understanding, that in fact a lot of the Russian economic progress, which by the way is very impressive no matter how you look at it, came at the expense of the Ukrainian colony. It is a self-defensive colony, but a colony nevertheless. I began to change my opinion on certain aspects of the Russian monarchy, although I did not throw the baby out with the bathwater. I do view the Russian monarchy as a very, very positive force. And my talk on Popodonostiev a few weeks ago, or whenever that was, is really the summary of a lot of what I maintain about that empire. So it's a very complicated question, but I want to talk about another empire that has a lot in common with Russia, not the least of which is that they both went out of existence after the nightmare of World War One, and that is the Empire of Austria-Hungary. It's significant for those of us who worry a lot about the Ukrainians, because a good chunk of Ukrainian speakers were under the Austrian Empire. I've also spoken about the Polish Empire on this program more than once, and a sizable portion of the Polish aristocracy was brought under Austrian control after Poland was dismembered in the last few years of the 18th century. So Austria is an empire that has a lot to do with those of us who are interested in Ukraine, who love Ukraine and Ukrainians, and particular their interpretation and their living of the Orthodox life. Austria did control much of Galicia, as well as Carpathorus, that small part of Ukrainian territory, or Rusyn territory, R-U-S-Y-N, that came under Hungary and therefore came under Vienna to some extent. And in taking the Polish, at least a portion of the Polish aristocracy, to some extent the Austrian Empire had to face a similar situation that the Polish Empire had to face many centuries before. But I've dealt with this program on the collapse of old Russia, the collapse of old Ukraine, the collapse of old Poland, and now I have to deal with the collapse of old Austria-Hungary. None of these things are pleasant to deal with, because I'm willing to say that, with a few exceptions, the situation that the people came under these empires, is far superior to what most Americans or Englishmen or Germans have to deal with today. That their cultural life was superior, their health was superior, their spiritual life was superior to what the average cubicle jockey has to work with today. Austria is a topic that I've been studying for a long time, only because it really just kind of comes on the heels of Polish and Ukrainian studies. You really can't avoid the Austrian Empire, and especially if you're worried about questions like royalism and nationalism, and the relationship between royalism and nationalism. Is it necessarily hostile? Can these things be accommodated? The Austrian Empire is something that comes up again and again and again. Some of the information I deal with today, and I have just mountains of material, as I always have, comes from an article written by Hans Kohn in 1963 called The Viability of the Austrian Empire. In other words, did the Austrian Empire have the internal resources to maintain itself if there was no World War One, but even if the fact that World War One occurred, could she actually have survived? And I want to make the claim, a very general claim, that the Rothschilds and Sassoons, your major banking establishments in Europe, had enough of royal power, whether it be in St. Petersburg, Vienna, Berlin. It's the point is that controlling a parliament is a heck of a lot easier than controlling a very religious, tradition-bound monarchy. And ultimately, that's the reason why the monarchies had to go. These empires, in spite of all their faults, and by the way, their faults as political leaders probably are not as bad as our faults as individuals. And so we have no position really to judge, especially, you know, hundreds of years in hindsight, that these empires actually function far superior than the political systems of the West, never mind the communist systems of the East, that have been controlled by big money and the major banking families. So it's with a heavy heart I deal with yet another fall of a very important empire in Europe, and that's what we're going to deal with based on a lot of the literature in the 60s and 70s in America, at least in the English language, that actually has not been bad and has not been particularly hostile to the Austrians and Hungarians the way it was hostile to the Russians. You didn't have a Soviet propaganda machine in the American Academy to manipulate the historical data concerning the Russian Empire. And you didn't have anything like this concerning Austria. So I think you have a better view, a more objective view anyway, concerning the Austrian Empire than you do the Russian Empire. So that's our topic for tonight. Hans Kohn makes the claim in his very important 1963 article that Hungary was the problem in the Austrian Empire, yeah, right up until 1914, that Hungary remained almost identically, from a political point of view, identical to Poland. It was an oligarchy, and it was an oligarchy that existed because it was protected by Vienna. Poland was an oligarchy that had no protection and therefore fell. But Hungary had an artificial lease on life because it was protected under the Viennese scepter until World War One. And so Hungary remained, and I use the term very loosely, a feudal society run by a handful of major magnate families right up until the war. Austria, on the other hand, was not feudal. In fact, Austria had within herself the mechanisms and mentality and material conditions necessary to change and adjust with the times, economically speaking. And even more than that, the non-German nationalities were strengthened in the East after 1867. You had a lot of loyal societies, and I'm using that word in a very technical sense. You had loyal societies within the empire straight up into World War One. The Austrian Germans, I mean, those German speakers who were a part of the Austrian Empire, who really were the core of the Austrian Empire, they venerated Bismarck. Hans Kohn makes the view, makes the point, and I think there's some truth to this, that there were some doubts within the Austrian mentality, German-speaking mentality, as to what the destiny of Austrian Germans truly was. I think there was some bias in the Austrian mentality that they really should have been the leaders of German unification. And that aspect of history, that marginalization of the southern Germans, the Austrians, is well known. It was Prussia, it was Bismarck, it was that vision that ended up winning, not the Austrian vision. And the Austrian Germans had a very strong veneration to that Prussian mentality. But, of course, Prussia had lots going for it that the Austrian Empire didn't have. The Prussia was unified. It was unified politically. It was unified linguistically. It was unified religiously in the Lutheran world. It had everything going for it. And I want to say, When I lectured on European nationalism and royalism and European history at the university level, and I did this for many years, I came to the conclusion that there is one variable that explains a heck of a lot. These successful states in Europe, these unified states, were unified primarily by a central religious mind. Religious unity meant everything. When you didn't have religious unity, you didn't have anything. And that's one thing that Prussia had, one thing that Austria did not have. In fact, at one time or another, Austria had almost every major religion in the world within its purview. Kohn makes the claim that the decay of the best of the Austrian Empire began to occur when Bosnia was annexed officially into the empire in 1878. Whether you come from a Serbian point of view, a Croat point of view, an Austrian or Hungarian point of view, this was a huge mistake. you're bringing into the empire an extremely nasty, violent, religious, civilizational, and ethnic battle in this little country, this little region of Bosnia. And even though the Austrians did fairly well in mediating some of these conflicts, it's even more than bringing this battle into the empire. It's that when Austria made its claim to the post-Turkish, in other words, as soon as Austria made its claim to a post-Turkish Balkans, it automatically made an enemy of the Russian Empire on the one hand, and on the other brought the Germans under Berlin into this alliance that will eventually explode into World War I. There were a lot of people at the time who viewed Austria as a rational and moderate alternative to a pan-Slavic movement coming from the east, as well as a pan-Germanic movement coming from the north. That Austria showed itself as a model in dealing with these sort of ideological movements, and that even more, Austria became a guide for those worried about how to deal with national movements within an imperial context. Those people who believe that nationalism might in fact be healthy, but only if brought within the mentality of a specific imperial house. And that Austria for a long time proved itself capable of dealing with change and specifically some of the most violent nationalist movements in all of Central and Eastern Europe. Is it possible that the trialist solution that was offered by the Croats, rejected, by the way, by the Hungarians, and this gets into a very, you know, my mother is a Hungarian woman, I come from a Hungarian family, as well as an Irish family on my father's side, and yet it's the Hungarians that really were the problem here. Was it possible to permit Vienna to become a trialist movement with you know, Austria, Hungary, and then the southern Slavs, you know, the Slovenes, Croats, and Serbs, as this third crown? That was the Croat idea in the 1880s and 1890s. I mean, after all, the empire made a lot of economic sense, especially to these fairly advanced Slavic societies like the Slovenes or the Czechs. And the monarchy, far from being unresponsive, spent a lot of time trying to develop the so-called backward areas of the empire. And the monarchy in Vienna was quite responsive to the needs of modern economics within what ultimately was a Catholic dynastic point of view. This was a very responsive monarchy who sought to control nationalist extremism for the sake of a limited Central and Eastern European economic federalism. And there were a lot of people both then and now who thought that this was not a bad compromise in European history, that Vienna, in fact, represented the most rational response to the modern mentality in Central Europe. Now, what were some of these forces? The Poles were a fairly wealthy elite society in the East. Although always desirous of their own state, they did very, very well under Vienna. The Ukrainians, Galicians, and Ruthenians, pretty much all the same group of people, did less well, but had no difficulty when Vienna took very serious, the Hungarians for that matter, took action against the Polish minority. The two big rejectionists are the Italians, needless to say, and the Czechs. The Jews, in Hans Kohn's estimation, generally speaking, backed this cosmopolitan state in Vienna because, among other reasons, they were worried about the Jewish policy both in Tsarist Russia, which of course was vehemently anti-Jewish, and in Germany and Berlin, which to some lesser extent was still also anti-Jewish. So the, you know, Jewish elites in urban areas viewed Vienna as the lesser of at least three evils. And so generally speaking, I don't want to exaggerate this, that the Jews were in favor of the Austrian Federation. And that there is some evidence that elite Jews in Vienna and elsewhere really hated Russia. They hated Russian Orthodoxy. They hated the Tsardom. They hated what they perceived to be the treatment of the Jews under the Tsar, and as a result, were quite willing to back Vienna. The civil service, which was dominated by German speakers, was one of the most important unifying elements. They were extremely competent. They were very monarchist in their general point of view. And this civil service sometimes doesn't get dealt with all that much in the literature, although that's been rectified in recent decades. These guys are a central point in cohesiveness, as well as the army. And I want to say that the officer corps in the army was open to talent and, generally speaking, was not discriminatory in terms of promotion. There was a problem in terms of language, of course. But talent could get you everywhere in the Austrian army. And even more than that, Franz Joseph, by the turn of the century, really had developed into not a father figure, but a grandfather figure. A man who really can be idealized, a man who can be treated almost as an idea of unity in and of himself. So you had many forces of cohesion, you had many forces of disunity, and sometimes it's very difficult to figure out who's on what side. The fact is that the violence of 1848, as artificial as myself, a lot of people think it is, it showed that the Austrian Empire was capable of taking modern considerations into its governing structure and changing and adapting in really in what is the best of royal government. Hans Kohn holds to the view that the war released many tensions. The war almost was a catharsis for Austrian society, and that it was capable of bringing people together that otherwise would have nothing in common. When studying Austria, there's always this problem. There are many specific reasons for believing that outside of World War I, the Austrian monarchy had a fairly pleasant future. But there's also that point of view that says that there really are no general reasons for adhering to the monarchy in Vienna. For all the history books out there on the Austrian Empire, it looks as if there are specific economic or ethnic reasons for supporting the empire. But that's a very weak source of loyalty. That's a very weak basis for holding this huge, powerful, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multi-linguistic, multi-civilizational empire together. And that's the problem. Studying Austria is never boring. And part of the reason that that's the case is that the Austrians, the civil service, the army, the Catholic Church, the monarch himself, as well as the office that he held, these are your basic general reasons for loyalty. But since German speakers were only a very small minority of the empire, something like 30% or less, that's not sufficient to keep the empire together. Okay, we're going to take a break now, and we're going to conclude this when we come back. Hang in there.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We are talking about that cauldron of nationalism in the 19th and early 20th century, the Austrian Empire. And I think what I want to do for the remainder of this broadcast is talk about the coalitions that formed, both to preserve the empire and its particular point of view relative to the national question, the religious question, and that coalition that wanted to destroy it. And I'm not necessarily passing judgment. I do believe that the empire was fairly humane. I believe that the Austrian Empire was as good as any system, political system, economic system, religious system, could do to contain some of the most difficult, severe, and violent nationalisms of the 19th century. Remember, Joseph II tried to imitate Peter the Great in Russia and failed. He tried to centralize power, and it's difficult to do that when you have very powerful Hungarian nobles that would not accept this. In 1848, who is it that saved the state? It was Croats and Romanians. Croats and Romanians saw the Austrian Empire a means of controlling their enemies. That these relatively powerless ethnic forces in Central Europe and Eastern Europe realized that without the mediating power of Vienna, they were in big trouble. But remember, despite the fact that the Hungarians were always a thorn in the side of Vienna, it was the Hungarian Catholic clergy that was one of the most most integral pro-Vienna element in Hungarian society. Although, by the 1870s, Catholics in Hungary were roughly 50% of the population. There's many reasons to believe that Austria was in the process of disintegrating, even when serfdom was eliminated in 1850. As there were to believe that she had a great future. In Hungary, the person of the landowner was sacrosanct, which meant that in 1850, when serfdom was eliminated, the serfs were eliminated without land. That was a big mistake. This is a mistake that Tsar Alexander II in St. Petersburg refused to make 11 years later when he freed his serfs. He freed them with land. In Hungary, the freed serfs became, in fact, poorer by 1860 than they were in 1850, and in fact, more and more power and land was concentrated in the hands of the magnates by 1860 than there were 10 years before in 1850. Hungary is an interesting case in political sociology in the sense that the nobility, especially the middle and lower nobility, as well as the capitalist middle class, worked together. They functioned as an economic unit. This was very important, and this is one of the central aspects of the political economy of Hungary between 1850 and 1870. The capitalists were not opposed to feudal landholding. In fact, they cooperated with it. This is not the case elsewhere. But you have something like 24% of the empire that was German-speaking. If you include all Hungarians plus Germans are about 48% of the population. So talking about those two groups of people is not sufficient. That's a problem in dealing with the history of the empire as well as the realities of trying to govern it at the time. The remainder of the empire were Slavic, but the unity among these people, the unity among the Slavs, could never exist. You had Pole versus Ukrainian, Croat versus Serb, Czech versus Slovak. In 1848, there was a conference in Prague based on the question, can the Slavs of the empire be unified? Of course, the answer was no, especially since the fact that the Serbs were never invited. The Czechs viewed themselves as the leaders of the Slavic peoples. They were the most Western. They absorbed a lot of German settlers after 1620. And the Czech movement in North Central Europe was very middle class, very modern, very progressive in the mentality of the day. The Czechs kind of looked down their nose at a lot of other Slavic peoples. And the Slovaks really suffered under Hungarian control. In fact, there were only five or six deputies in the Hungarian parliament, and the Hungarian oligarchy had passed a law that forbade them to ever speak in that parliament. The Slovaks were deprived of education under Hungarian control because all education amongst those living within the borders of the Kingdom of Hungary had to be in the Magyar language. So, as far as the non-Germans of the empire is concerned, the Czech middle class is very, very powerful. The Hungarians had their nobility. They had a small middle class that functioned along with the nobility. But the Ukrainians and Slovaks had absolutely nothing. And the wild card, I mean, you know, both in terms of political and economic power, and the wild card really were the Polish aristocracy. The Czechs sought autonomy, although Poles, and it really depended on the moment, the Poles really wanted to see their state restored, but in the meantime really cared about one thing. That was to make sure that the Hungarians knew their place, and especially the Ukrainians knew their place. Now, there's another group that sometimes doesn't get treated as a separate organization, ethnic organization, and that is the Ruthenians or Ukrainians living in the Carpathian Mountains within Hungarian control. And these are called today the Carpatho-Rusyns. They in the second half of the 19th century were dominated by really one or two major magnate families from Hungary. The Carpatho-Rusyn peasantry was deliberately kept illiterate by the Hungarian overlords. And this isn't, you know, Hungary in the sense of this ethnic unity. It's Hungary really represented by one or two major families of the day. Those Orthodox Ukrainians living in this area who became Catholics, so-called unions, these were backed by the Hungarian landlords. So I want to say that this so-called Carpatho-Rusyn Uniate movement in this country, based in Pittsburgh, is of course a total fraud. These people exist only because the Hungarian landlords wanted a clerical class loyal to Rome that would do the bidding of really the one or two major Hungarian families that dominated this part of Ukraine. Here you have a case of a completely fraudulent religion, a religion based exclusively and solely on the interests of a few landlords with close connections to Vienna. A few landlords who kept the Carpatho-Rusyn peasantry completely ignorant, when in fact it was the Ukrainian nationalist movement in Ukraine proper who wanted to make sure that they were literate so that they could fight, created a Catholic clergy using the Orthodox Byzantine rite, really only to fool the common population who really didn't know one way or the other, so that their control over the peasantry can be complete and can exist without without opposition. Some of these Uniate clergy eventually figured out the fact that they were total pawns in this game, and they looked to Russia for salvation. And that group became known as the Old Ruthenians, a group that finally figured out that their existence was based exclusively on ethnic and religious control, really economic control. That it's a religion that came out of a matrix of economic domination. And the Hungarian control over the Ruthenian people existed only because of the Uniate clergy. The Uniate clergy were permitted by the Hungarian government only to know that which could justify Hungarian control over this part of the world. Carpatho-Rus is still a highly controversial part of Ukrainian history. Some of them still look to Russia, some look to Ukraine, some even look to the old Hungarian state. The Carpatho-Rusyns haven't gotten the attention that they deserve, in my opinion. And they really are. They're a group of people, a lot like the Slovaks, who have been kept deliberately ignorant by a landlord class. Now, the Slovenes are a different matter altogether. The Slovenes are a very westernized, very pro-German population in the Balkans who wanted to see a Austrian Empire maintain itself, but to maintain itself as a federation of loosely connected ethnic groups and religious groups. Really, the Slovenes, because of their industriousness, of their closeness to the German population, of the free trade agreements that they have with the German-speaking areas of the empire, they maintained their independence. They did precisely what they wanted to do. In the past, in my university lectures, I've actually made a parallel between the Slovenians and the Austrian German speakers with the Georgians and Armenians relative to the Soviet Union. Both groups are very industrious, extremely intelligent, and were able to kind of write their own ticket because they were always so productive that they were able to convince their empires, the overlords, to pretty much leave them alone. It was in the empire's interest to leave them alone because their production was just incredible. And the Slovenes had that very enviable position in the Austrian Empire, very much the way that the Georgians had that enviable position in the Soviet Union. Now, the Croats, I'm going to make a controversial claim and say that the Croats were probably the most loyal non-Germanic part of the Austrian Empire. They hated the fact that they had some kind of irregular relationship with Hungary. They would not be absorbed into Hungary, even though they had technically been a part of the Hungarian Empire for many, many centuries. The Hungarian state, I should say, not empire. So the Croats became very loyal to Vienna because they had the most clear-cut reason to support Franz Joseph as a way to protect them from Hungarian domination. One problem with Hungarian nationalism. The one problem with Hungarian nationalism is that they demanded that anybody who lived within their territory speak Magyar and be fully loyal to the Hungarian ruling class, that is to say, the landlord class. This is a problem. It would seem to me that consistent nationalism would insist that those who are traditionally Hungarians should be Hungarians in their own territory. Those who are not should be allies within Hungarian territory, but otherwise maintaining their own customs. The Hungarian idea was very different. The Hungarian idea is that they should all speak Magyar no matter who they are. And so the Hungarians made enemies out of the Ukrainians, out of the Croats, and out of the Slovaks. Not to mention the Poles. The Hungarian nationalism failed precisely because of this absolutist demand, and that the Croats, as a result, became vehemently anti-Hungarian. And, in fact, one of the great merits of the Croat contribution to European history is their insistence on the trialist solution. You had the dual monarchy after 1848. You had the Germans in Austria, the Hungarians in Hungary, creating the dual monarchy, and so that the southern Slavs, led by the Croats, said, well then, why not have a third monarchy based on the South Slavic mentality? Croats, Serbs, even the Muslims, to some extent. This was the Croatian solution. Needless to say, the Hungarians were violently opposed to this. The Serbs in Vojvodina, in the extreme southern part of the Austrian Empire, were a free peasantry. They were highly progressive. They were very prosperous economically. And the Orthodox Serbs within the empire were generally supportive of Vienna because they like the idea of having the empire protect them from the Roman Catholic elements who wanted to assimilate them. So when you talk about these coalitions, those who were in favor of Austria, those who were opposed to Austria, it starts getting very, very complicated. I could give you a tentative sense of who belongs where. You had all the German speakers, you had the Czechs, you had the Slovenes, you had probably the majority of the Serbs, you probably had the majority of Ukrainians, you had the Catholic clergy, you had the bureaucracy and army. These were the people who wanted to maintain the empire more or less as it was, or at the very least, as a federative union. Your rejectionists had a tendency to be the middle class of the Czechs, a lot of the Hungarian extremists, some of the Italians, and a handful of the Orthodox who wanted to join with Russia. And they wanted to join with Russia largely because of the oppression of either Hungary or Poland. So, when World War I blows up, you have this absolutely disastrous ethnic, religious, civilizational battle. And the fact is that Europe, after 1918-1920, would have been very well served if the Austrian Empire would have been restored, rather than the bankers demand that democratic a society should be formed, that of course could be easily controlled by the major banking houses. And I want to say that it was the Rothschild Empire that demanded that parliamentarism be imported everywhere in the world, because it was very easy for the big banking houses to manipulate elections, no different than the Rothschild satellite, Goldman Sachs, controlled the elections in this country. If you guys go to FEC.gov, the Federal Election Commission, you'll see how Goldman Sachs gives tens of millions of dollars to both parties every election, with the full expectation of being repaid by the regime. That concludes our talk for the day. I have been wanting to talk about Vienna for a very, very long time. I want to say that the empires, the monarchies of Europe in the 19th century were far superior, morally, socially, spiritually, than anything that we have today. And I think that's one thesis, maybe, that a lot of listeners to this network and a lot of my fellow hosts and friends here would agree with. That world is gone. That world was destroyed, not by the actions necessarily of those involved, but by the big banking families that profited from World War I and therefore helped to create World War II, that destroyed tens of millions of European young men in that generation. And I don't think we're ever going to recover from that outside of a full-blown royalist Christian revolution in Europe and America. So I want to say that I don't care what anyone says. I stand with at least some of the Romanovs. I stand with the Habsburgs. I stand with so many of those entities and houses that hold to the European old era. And that the new era is evil. It is the era of the banks. It is the era of debt. It is the era of the worst of state capitalism. And I set my face against it. And I know that the regime that exists and that rules the world today in 2010 is the direct descendant of these people who created World War I, who created World War II, and who profited from it. And I want to thank you for listening. God bless, and bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Thank you.
tuned into Radio Aryan.